You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
Beginning in the Middle Ages, learned men connected the dots between Eden and Calvary to show the many correspondences. If Mary was a helpmate to Jesus in the redemption of man, and if Jesus redeemed us on the cross, then Mary standing at the foot of the cross must be more than just coincidence. If Mary is the mother of the living, then Mary's word to St. John, "Behold thy mother," must have some deeper meaning. If Mary is the woman foretold in Genesis, then we could explain Jesus calling her woman. From the cross, a reference to the Eve and Mary analogy. If the tree of the cross corresponds to the tree of life of Genesis, then the new Adam and the new Eve are there united at the new tree. Rather than the death wrought by our first parents at the tree of knowledge of good and evil, at that moment they bring forth our new life.
Graham Greene's great novel, The Power and Glory, is a very moving presentation of how Catholic faith has survived under severe persecution. It is a portrait of an imperfect Catholic's deep faith and ultimate heroism. Graham Greene, whose long life from 1901 to 1991 almost spanned the 20th century, and he was one of that century's greatest novelists. Educated at Oxford, was a sub-editor on the Times. He converted to Catholicism in 1926 and reported on the religious persecution of Catholics in Mexico in 1938 in a book called The Lawless Roads, which served as a background for his famous novel, The Power and the Glory, one of his several Catholic novels. During the war, he worked for the British Secret Service in Sierra Leone, and he traveled widely. Most of his novels have been filmed, including The Third Man. One critic, William Golding, says, "Graham Greene was in a class by himself. He will be read and remembered as the ultimate chronicler of 20th century man's consciousness and anxiety." As I promised, I'm going to read a few excerpts from this novel. This novel concerns a poor, remote section of southern Mexico, where the Red Shirts, this is the government of Calles, a Marxist Masonic government. Calles and his Red Shirts had taken control of Mexico. God had been outlawed, and priests had been systematically hunted down and killed. Now the last priest is on the run. Too human to be a hero and to indulge in heroism. Too humble for martyrdom. The little worldly whiskey priest is nevertheless impelled toward his squalid Calvary, as much as by his own compassion for humanity as by the efforts of his pursuers. So we start. I'm going to step through the novel, alighting for passages a few pages long as we go, not to give you as much an idea of the overall plot, but to present vignettes of what it was like to be a Catholic priest during this time of terrible persecution. Half a dozen huts of mud and wattle stood in a clearing. Two were in ruins. A few pigs rooted around. An old woman carried a burning ember from hut to hut, lighting a little fire in the center of each floor to fill the hut with smoke and keep mosquitoes away. Women lived in two of the huts, pigs in another. In the last unruined hut where maize was stored, an old man and a boy and a tribe of rats. The stranger came into the clearing. He wore what used to be town shoes, black and pointed. Only the uppers were left, so that he walked, for all intents, barefoot. The shoes were symbolic, like the cobweb flags in churches. He wore a shirt like a pair of black torn trousers, and he carried his attaché case as if he were a season ticket holder. He had nearly reached the state of permanency, too, but he carried about with him the scars of time. The damaged shoes implied a different past. The lines of his face suggested hopes and fears of the future. The old woman with the ember stopped between two huts and watched him. He came into the clearing with his eyes on the ground and his shoulders hunched, as if he felt exposed. The old man advanced to meet him. He took the stranger's hands and kissed it. "Can you let me have a hammock for the night?" "Our father, for a hammock you must go to a town. Here you must take only the luck of the road." "Never mind. Anywhere to lie down." "Can you give me a little spirit?" Coffee, Father, we have nothing else. Some food? We have no food. Never mind. The boy came out of the hut and watched them. Everybody watched. It was like a bullfight. The animal was tired, and they waited for the next move. They were not hard-hearted. They were watching the rare spectacle of something worse off than themselves. He limped toward the hut. Inside, it was dark from the knees upwards. There was no flame on the floor. The place was half filled by a stack of maize and rats rustling among the dry outer leaves. There was a bed made of earth with a straw mat on it, and two packing cases made a table. The stranger lay down, and the old man closed the door on them both. Is it safe? The boy will watch. He knows. Were you expecting me? No, Father. It is 5 years since we have seen a priest. It was bound to happen one day. He fell uneasily asleep, and the old man crouched on the floor, fanning the flames with his breath. Somebody tapped on the door. The priest jerked upright. It's all right, the old man said. Just your coffee, Father. He brought it to him, gray maize coffee, smoking in a tin mug. But the priest was too tired to drink. He lay on his side perfectly still. A rat watched him from the maize. The soldiers were here yesterday, the old man said. Abe blew on the fire. The smoke poured up and filled the hut. The priest began to cough, and the rats moved quickly like the shadow of a hand back into the stack. The boy, Father, has not been baptized. The last priest was here wanted 2 pesos. I only have 1 pesos. Now I only have 50 centavos. Tomorrow, the priest said wearily. Will you say Mass, Father, in the morning? Yes, yes. And confession, Father. Will you hear our confessions? Yes. But let me sleep first. He turned on his back and closed his eyes to keep out the smoke. We have no money, Father, to give you. The other priest, Padre Jose, give me some clothes instead, he said impatiently. But we have only what we wear. Take mine in exchange. The old man hung dubiously to himself, glancing sideways at what the fire showed of the black torn cloth. If I must, Father, he said. He blew quietly at the fire for a few minutes. The priest's eyes closed again. After 5 years, there is so much to confess. The priest sat up quickly. What was that? He said. You were dreaming, Father. The boy will warn us if the soldiers come. I was only saying, can't you let me sleep for 5 minutes? He lay down again. Somewhere in one of the woman's huts, someone was singing. I went down to my field, and there I found a rose. The old man said softly, it would be such a pity if the soldiers came before we had time. Such a burden on poor souls, Father. The priest shouldered himself upright against the wall and said furiously, very well, begin. I'll hear your confession. The rat shuffled in amaze. Go on, then, he said. Don't waste time. Hurry. When did you last? The old man knelt beside the fire, and across the clearing the woman sang. I went down to my field, and the rose was withered. 5 years ago, he paused and blew at the fire. It's hard to remember, Father. Have you sinned against purity? The priest leant against the wall with his legs drawn up beneath him, and the rats, accustomed to the voices, moved again and amazed. The old man picked out his sins with difficulty, blowing at the fire. Make a good act of contrition, the priest said. Have you a rosary? Then say the joyful mysteries. His eyes closed. His lips and tongue stumbled over the absolution, failed to finish. He sprang awake again. Can I bring the women? The old man was saying. It is 5 years. Oh, let them come. Let them all come, the priest cried angrily. I'm your servant. He put his hand over his eyes and began to weep. The old man opened the door. It was not completely dark outside, under the enormous arc of starry, ill-lit sky. He went across to the woman's huts and knocked. Come, he said. You must say your confessions. It's only polite to the Father. They wailed at him that they were tired. The morning would do. Would you insult him, he said. What do you think he's come here for? He's a very holy Father. He's in my hut now, weeping for our sins. He hustled them out one by one. They picked their way across the clearing toward the hut. And the old man set off down the path toward the river, to take the place of the boy who watched the ford for soldiers. And now we move forward in the story. I want to inform you ahead of time that when the priest bites the onion in this section, it's to hide the altar wine on his breath. Suddenly, out of the forest 100 yards away, an officer rode. In the absolute stillness, you could hear the creaking of his revolver holster as he turned and waved. All round the little clearing, the police appeared. They must have marched very quickly, for only the officer had a horse. Rifles at the trail, they approached the small group of huts, an exaggerated and rather absurd show of force. One man had a puttee trailing behind him. It had probably caught on something in the forest. He tripped on it and fell with a great clatter of cartridge bell on gun stock. The lieutenant on the horse looked around, then turned his bitter and angry face upon the silent huts. The woman was pulling at him from inside the hut. She said, "Bite this, quick, there's no time." He turned his back on the advancing police and came into the dusk of the room. She had a small raw onion in her hand. "Bite it," she said. He bit it and began to weep. "Is that any better?" she said. He could hear the pad of the cautious horse hooves advancing between the huts. "It's horrible," he said with a giggle. "Give it to me." She made it disappear somewhere into her clothes. "It's a trick all women seem to know. Where's my case?" "Never mind your case. Get onto the bed." Before he could move, a horse blocked the way. They could see a leg and riding boots piped with scarlet. Brass fittings gleamed. A hand and a glove rested on a high pommel. Maria put a hand upon his arm. It was as near as she had ever come to a movement of affection. Affection was taboo between them. We'll break now. This is Chuck Coughlin.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. Today on Setting the Record Straight, we're going through a novel by Graham Greene, The Power and the Glory. So let's continue. A voice cried, "Come on out, all of you." The horse stamped, a little pillar of dust went up. "Come on out," I said. Somewhere a shot was fired. The priest left the hut. The dawn had really broken. Light feathers of color were blown up into the sky. A man still held his gun pointed upward. A little balloon of gray smoke hung at the muzzle. Was this how the agony would start? Out of all the huts, the villagers were reluctantly emerging. The children first. They were inquisitive and unfrightened. The men and women had the air already of people condemned by authority. Authority was never wrong. None of them looked at the priest. They stared at the ground and waited. Only the children watched the horse as if it were the most important thing there. The lieutenant said, "Search the huts." A soldier came to the lieutenant and saluted sketchily and said, "They're all here. You found nothing suspicious?" "No." "Then look again." Once more, time stopped like a broken clock. Again, the policeman approached and reported nothing. The lieutenant barked out, "Attention, all of you. Listen to me." The outer ring of police closed in, pushing the villagers together into a small group in front of the lieutenant. Only the children were left free. The priest saw his own child standing close to the lieutenant's horse. She could just reach above his boot. She put up her hand and touched the leather. The lieutenant said, "I'm looking for two men. One is a gringo, a Yankee, a murderer, and I can see very well he's not here. There's a reward of 500 pesos for his capture. Keep your eyes open." He paused. His eye ran over them. The priest felt his gaze come to rest. He looked down like the others at the ground. "The other," the lieutenant said, "is a priest." He raised his voice. "You know what that means? A traitor to the Republic. Anyone who shelters him is a traitor, too." Their immobility seemed to anger him. He said, "You fools, if you still believe what priests tell you. All they want is your money. What has God ever done for you? Have you got enough to eat? Have your children got enough to eat? Instead of food, they talk to you about heaven. Oh, everything will be fine after you're dead, they say. I tell you, everything will be fine when they are dead. and you must help." The child had her hand on his boot. He looked down at her with dark affection. He said with conviction, "This child is worth more than the Pope in Rome." The police leant on their guns. One of them yawned. The turkey cock went hissing back towards the hut. The lieutenant said, "If you've seen this priest, speak up. There's a reward of 700 pesos. Nobody spoke. The lieutenant yanked his horse's head round toward them. He said, "We know he's in this district. Perhaps you don't know what happened to a man in Concepcion." One of the women began to weep. He said, "Come up, one after the other, and let me have your names." "No, not the women, the men." They filed sullenly up, and he questioned them. "What's your name? What do you do? Married? Which is your wife? Have you heard of this priest?" Only one man now stood between the priest and the horse's head. He recited an act of contrition silently with only half a mind. "My sins, because they've crucified my loving Savior, but above all they've offended." He was alone in front of the lieutenant. "I hereby resolve never more to offend thee." It was a formal act, because a man has to be prepared. It was like making your will. It might be as valueless. "Your name?" The name of the man in Concepcion came back to him. He said, "Montes." "Have you ever seen the priest?" "No." "What do you do?" "I am a little man." "Are you married?" "Yes." "Which is your wife?" Maria suddenly broke out. "I'm his wife." "Why do you want to ask so many questions? Do you think he looks like a priest?" The lieutenant was examining something on the pommel of his saddle. It seemed to be an old photograph. "Let me see your hands," he said. The priest held them up. They were hard as a laborer's. Suddenly, the lieutenant leaned down from his saddle and smelled his breath. There was complete silence among the villagers. A dangerous silence, because it seemed to convey to the lieutenant a fear. He stared back at the hollow, stubbled face, looked back at the photograph. "All right," he said, "next." And then as the priest stepped aside, "Wait." He put his hands down to Brigitte's head and gently tugged at her black stiff hair. She said, "Look up. You know everyone in this village, don't you?" "Yes," she said. "Who's that man, then? What's his name?" "I don't know," the child said. The lieutenant caught his breath. "You don't know his name? Is he a stranger?" Maria cried. "Why, the child doesn't know her own name. Ask her who her father is." "Who's your father?" The child stared up at the lieutenant and then turned her knowing eyes upon the priest. "I beg your pardon for all my sins," he was repeating to himself, and his fingers were crossed for luck. The child said, "That's him, there." "All right," the lieutenant said. "Next." The priest stood with his hands clasped in front of him. Again, death had been postponed. He felt an enormous temptation to throw himself in front of the lieutenant and declare himself, "I'm the one you want." Would they shoot him out of hand? A delusive promise of peace tempted him. Far up in the sky, a vulture watched. They must appear from that height as two groups of carnivorous animals who might at any time break into conflict. And it waited there, a tiny black spot for carrion. Death was not the end of pain. To believe in peace was a kind of heresy. The lieutenant said, "Is no one willing to help? You heard what happened at Concepcion. I took a hostage there, and when I found that this priest had been in the neighborhood, I put the man against the nearest tree. I found out because there's always someone who changes his mind. Perhaps because somebody in Concepcion's loved the man's wife and wanted him out of the way. It's not my business to look into reasons. I only know we found wine later in Concepcion. Perhaps there's somebody in this village. Somebody who wants your piece of land or your cow. It's much safer to speak now, because I'm going to take a hostage from here, too." He paused, and then he said, "There's no need even to speak. If he's here among you, just look at him. No one will know then it was you that gave him away. He won't know himself if you're afraid of his curses. Now, this is your last chance." The priest looked at the ground. He wasn't going to make it difficult for the man who gave him away. Right, the lieutenant said. Then I shall choose my man. You brought it on yourselves. He broke out suddenly. Why won't you trust me? I don't want any of you to die. In my eyes, can't you understand? You're worth far more than he is. I want to give you... He made a gesture with his hands, which was valueless, because no one saw him. Everything, he said in a dull voice. You there, I'll take you. A woman screamed, that's my boy, that's Miguel, you can't take my boy, he said dully. Every man here is somebody's husband or somebody's son, I know that. The priest stood silently with his hands clasped. His knuckles whitened as he gripped. He could feel all around him the beginning of hate, because he was no one's husband or son. He said, Lieutenant, what do you want? I'm getting too old to be much good in the fields. Take me. A rout of pigs came rushing round the corner of the hut, taking no notice of anybody. The soldier finished his putti and stood up. The sunlight coming above the forest winked above the bottles on the gaseous stall. The lieutenant said, I'm choosing a hostage, not offering freed and board lodging to the lazy. If you're no good in the fields, you're no good as a hostage. He gave an order. Tie the man's hands and bring him along. It took no time at all for the police to be gone. They took with him two or three chickens, a turkey, and the man called Miguel. The priest said aloud, I did my best, he went on. It's your job to give me up. What do you expect me to do? It's not my job to be caught. One of the men said, That's all right, Father. Only will you be careful to see that you don't leave any wine behind like you did at Concepcion. Another said, It's no good staying here, Father. They'll get you in the end. They won't forget your face again. Better go north to the mountains over the border.
It's a fine state over the border, a woman said.
They've still got churches there. Nobody can go in them, of course, but they're there. Why, I've heard that there are priests too in the towns. A cousin of mine went over the mountains to Las Casas once and heard Mass in a house with a proper altar, and the priests all dressed up like in the old days. You'd be happy there, Father. The priest followed Maria into the hut. The bottle of brandy lay on the table. He touched it with his fingers. There wasn't much left, he said. My case, Maria, where's my case? It's too dangerous to carry that around anymore, Maria said. How else can I take the wine? There isn't any wine. What do you mean? She said, I'm not going to bring trouble on you and everyone else. I've broken the bottle, even if it brings a curse. He said gently and sadly, You mustn't be superstitious. That was simply wine. There's nothing sacred in wine. Only it's hard to get hold of here. That's why I kept a store of it in Concepcion. But they found that. Now perhaps you'll go. Go away altogether. You're no good anymore to anyone, she said fiercely. Don't you understand, Father, they don't want you anymore. Oh, yes, he said, I understand.
But it's not what you want or I want, he said savagely.
Yeah, I know about things. I went to school. I'm not like these others, ignorant. I know you're a bad priest. That time we worked together, that wasn't all you've done. I've heard things I can tell you. Do you think God wants you to stay and die a wispy priest like you? He stood patiently in front of her, as he had stood in front of the lieutenant, listening.
We'll break now and return in a moment, as the priest is bidding farewell to Maria and begins to travel off to save himself.
Redbox Media, now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
We're listening to The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene, a great Catholic novel about a period of enormous persecution. One historian says that it's the greatest religious persecution in history since Elizabeth I persecuted the Irish Catholics and the Catholics in Britain. Just before the break, we heard the priest saying goodbye to Maria, with whom he has a small daughter. He's about to flee into the jungle, having narrowly escaped the soldiers who would have executed him. He hadn't known she was capable of all his thought, she said. Suppose you die. You'll be a martyr, won't you? What kind of martyr do you think you'd be? It's enough to make people mock. That had never occurred to him, that anybody would consider him a martyr. He said, it's difficult, very difficult. I think about it. I don't want the church to be mocked. Think about it over the border then. Well, she said, when you know what happened, I was proud. I thought the good days would come back. It's not everyone who's a priest's woman. And the child, I thought you could do a lot for her. But you might as well be a thief for all the good. He said vaguely, there's been a lot of good thieves. For God's sake, take this brandy and go. There was one thing, he said, in my case, there was something. Go and find it yourself on the rubbish tip, then. I won't touch it again. And the child, he said, you're a good woman, Maria. You try and bring her up well as a Christian. She'll never be good for anything, you can see that. She can't be very bad at her age, he implored her. She'll go on the way she's begun. He said, the next Mass, I say, will be for her. She wasn't even listening. She said, she's bad through and through. He was aware of faith dying out between the bed and the door. The Mass would soon mean no more to anyone than a black cat crossing the path. He was risking all their lives for the sake of spilt salt or a crossed finger. Oh, well, he said sadly. Perhaps one day when things are better, he sketched a cross and blessed her. But she stood impatiently before him, willing him to be gone forever. Well, goodbye, Maria. Goodbye. The priest has had a very narrow escape. Now he knows there's a large reward for turning him in to be executed. So let's see what happens next. So the priest leaves. They advise him to go north, but instead he goes south. And Green writes, he was traveling in the actual track of the police. So long as he went slowly and didn't overtake any stragglers, it seemed a fairly safe route. What he wanted now was wine. Without it, he was useless. He might as well escape north into the mountains and the safe state beyond, where the worst that could happen to him was a fine and a few days in prison because he couldn't pay. But he wasn't ready yet for the final surrender. Every small surrender had to be paid for in a further endurance. And now he felt the need of somehow ransoming his child. He would stay another month, another year, jogging up and down on the mule. He tried to bribe God with promises of firmness. The mule suddenly dug in its hooves and stopped dead. A tiny green snake raised itself on the path and then hissed away into the grass like a match flame. The mule went on. When he came near a village, he would stop the mule and advance as close as he could on foot. The police might have stopped there. Then he would ride quickly through, speaking to nobody beyond a Buenos Dias. And again on the forest path, he would pick up the track of the lieutenant's horse. He had no clear idea now about anything. He only wanted to put as great a distance as possible between him and the village where he had spent the night. He goes on, and he soon comes upon a man he'd seen before, a half-caste, a mestizo.
I am here, Father. The half-caste seemed to take a long breath for a surprising stilted statement. On an errand of mercy.
An errand of mercy?
Well, Father, you're the only priest this side of Las Casas, and the man's dying.
What man?
The Yankee.
What are you talking about?
The one the police wanted. He robbed a bank, you know the one I mean.
He wouldn't need me, the priest said impatiently. Oh, he's a good Catholic, Father. Scratching under his armpit, he didn't look at the priest.
He's dying, and you and I wouldn't like to have on our conscience what that meant.
We shall be lucky if we have it worse.
Oh, what do you mean, Father? The priest said. He only killed and robbed.
He hasn't betrayed his friends. Holy Mother of God, I never...
We both have. Are the mules ready?
Yes, Father. We'll start then.
Where are you going? The half-caste said.
To Las Casas.
The half-caste held on to his stirrup leather and he was reminded of their first meeting. "You're a fine priest," he wailed up to him. "Your bishop ought to hear this. A man's dying, wants to confess, and just because you want to get to the city."
"Why do you think me such a fool?" the priest said.
"I know why you've come. You're the only one they've got who can recognize me, and they can't follow me into this state."
"Now if I ask you where this American is, you'll tell me, I know. You don't have to speak. That he's just the other side."
"Oh, no, Father, you're wrong there. He's just this side. A mile or two makes no difference." "It's an awful thing, Father," the half-caste said, "never to be believed just because once, well, I admit it." The priest kicked his mule into motion. The half-caste trotted at his stirrup. "I remember," the priest said, "that you told me you'd never forget my face." "And I haven't," the man put in triumphantly, "or I wouldn't be here, would I? Listen, Father, I'll admit a lot. You don't know how reward will tempt a poor man like me. And when you wouldn't trust me, I thought, well, that's how he feels. I'll show him. But I'm a good Catholic, Father, and when a dying man wants a priest..." The priest said uneasily, "Why should I put my head in your noose? It was too absurd." "Look, Father." The half-caste was holding up a scrap of paper. The familiar writing caught the priest's attention. The large, deliberate handwriting of a child. The paper had been used to wrap food. It was smeared and greasy. He read,
"The Prince of Denmark is wondering whether he should kill himself or not."
"No, no, Father. The other side. That's nothing." The priest turned the paper and read a single phrase written in English, in blunt pencil. "For Christ's sake, Father." The mule, unbeaten, lapsed into a slow, heavy walk. The priest made no attempt to urge it on. This piece of paper left no doubt whatever. He asked, "How did this come to you?" "It was this way, Father. I was with the police, and they shot him. It was in a village on the other side. He picked up a child to act as a screen, but of course the soldiers didn't pay any attention. It was only an Indian. They were both shot, but he escaped." "Then how?" "It was this way, Father." And he told how he came upon the American who had been shot in the stomach. "How could he have escaped then?" "Oh, Father, he's a man of superhuman strength. He was dying. He wanted a priest." "How did he tell you that?" "It needed only two words, Father." Then to prove the story, the man had found enough strength to write this note. The story had as many holes in it as a sieve. But what remained was this note, like a memorial stone you couldn't overlook. "You don't trust me, Father." "Oh, no, I don't trust you. You think I'm lying. Most of it is lies." He pulled up the mule, facing south. He was quite certain this was a trap. Probably the half-castes had suggested it. But it was a fact that the American was there dying. A man with all that on his soul. The oddest thing of all was that he felt quite cheerful. He had never really believed in this peace. He had dreamed of it so often on the other side. Now that it meant no more to him than a dream, he began to whistle a tune.
Something he had heard once.
"I found a rose in my field." It was time he woke up. It wouldn't really have been a good dream, that confession in Las Casas, when he would have had to admit, as well as everything else, that he had denied confession to a dying man. "Will the man still be alive?" "I think so, Father." "How far is it?" 4-5 hours, Father." "You could take it in turns to ride the other mule." The priest turned his mule back and called out to the guide.
The man dismounted and stood inertly there while he explained.
The only remark he made was to the half-caste,
motioning him into the saddle.
The priest began to whistle again. "I have a rose," the only tune he knew. "There," the half-caste said, with a sort of whinny of triumph, as though he had lain innocently all these 7 hours
under the suspicion of lying.
He pointed across the barranca to a group of Indian huts on a peninsula of a rock jutting out across the chasm. They were perhaps 200 yards away, but it would take another hour at least to reach them, winding down 1,000 feet, then up another 1,000. The priest sat on his mule, watching intently. He could see no movement anywhere. "There doesn't seem to be anybody about." "Well," the half-caste said, "you didn't expect anybody, did you? Except him. He's there. You'll soon find out that." The priest dismounted. "What are you doing now?" the half-caste said despairingly. "We shan't need the mules anymore. They can be taken back." "Not need them? How are you going to get away from here? Oh, the priest said. I won't have to think about that, will I? He counted out 40 pesos and said to the muleteer, I hired you for Las Casas. Well, this is your good luck. 6 days' pay. You don't want any more, Father? No. I think you better get away from here quickly. The half-caste said excitedly, We can't walk all that way, Father. The man's dying. We can go just as quickly on our own hooves. Now, friend, be off.
The mestizo watched the mules pick their way along the narrow stone path
with a look of wistful greed. Now, the priest said briskly, we won't delay any more, and he started down the path with a small sack slung over his shoulder. He could hear the half-caste panting after him. His wind was bad. So they climbed down the chasm and up the other side. This way, Father, the half-caste said, taking the lead, scrambling away from the path up the rocks to the little plateau. He looked anxious, almost as if he had been expecting something to happen before this. There were about a dozen huts. They stood quiet like tombs against the heavy sky. A storm was coming up. The priest felt a nervous impatience. He had walked into this trap. The least they could do was to close it quickly, finish everything off. He wondered whether they would suddenly shoot him down from one of the huts. He had come to the very edge of time. Soon there would be no tomorrow and no yesterday. Just existence going on forever.
We break now.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin, bringing to light great Catholic literature. For this program, The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene. We continue.
He wondered whether they would suddenly shoot him down from one of the huts. He had come to the very edge of time. Soon there would be no tomorrow and no yesterday. His voice broke uncertainly when he said, Well, we're here. Where's this Yankee? Oh, yes, the Yankee, the half-caste said, jumping a little. It was as if for a moment he had forgotten the pretext. He was over there when I left him. Well, he couldn't have moved, could he? If it hadn't been for that letter, he would have doubted the very existence of the American. He began to walk across the little silent clearing toward the hut. Would they shoot him before he got to the entrance? It was like walking a plank blindfold. You didn't know at what point you would step off into space forever. He looked around. The mestizo stood in the clearing. The priest turned and went in. The American was there all right. Whether he was alive was another matter. He lay on a straw mat with his eyes closed and his mouth open and his hands on his belly like a child with a stomachache. The priest knelt down and put his face near the man's mouth, trying to hear the breathing. A heavy smell came up to him, a mixture of vomit and cigar smoke and stale drink. It would take more than a few lilies to hide this corruption. A very faint voice close to his ear said in English, Beat it, Father. Outside the door in the stormy sunlight, the mestizo stood staring toward the hut. So you're alive, are you? The priest said briskly. Better hurry. You haven't got long. Beat it, Father. You wanted me, didn't you? You're a Catholic. Beat it, the voice whispered again, as if those were the only words he could remember of a lesson learnt some while ago. Come now, the priest said. How long is it since you went to confession? The eyelids rolled up, and astonished eyes looked at him.
The man said in a muffled voice,
10 years, I guess. What are you doing here anyway? You asked for a priest. Come now, 10 years is a long time. You've got to beat it, Father, the man said. He was like a reptile, crushed at one end. He said in a strange voice, That bastard, the priest said furiously.
What sort of confession is this? I make 5 hours' journey, and all I get out of you are evil words. It seemed to him horribly unfair that his uselessness would return with his danger. He couldn't do anything for a man like that.
Listen, Father, the man said.
I am listening. You beat it out of here quick. I haven't come all this way to talk about myself, the priest said. The sooner your confession's done, the sooner I will be gone. You needn't trouble about me, I'm through.
You mean damn, the priest said angrily.
Sure, damn, the man replied, licking blood away from his lips. You listen to me, the priest said, leaning closer to the stale and nauseating smell. I have come here to listen to your confession. Do you want to confess?
No.
Did you write that note?
Maybe. I know what you want to tell me. I know it. Do you understand? Let that be. Remember, you're dying. Don't depend too much on God's mercy. He has given you this chance. He may not give you another. What sort of life have you led all these years? Does it seem so grand now? You've killed a lot of people, that's about all. Anybody could do that for a while, and then he is killed too. Just as you're killed. Father. Yes, the priest gave an impatient sigh. Leaning closer, he hoped for a moment at last he had got the man started on some meager train of sorrow. You take my gun, Father. See what I mean, under my arm? I haven't any use for a gun. Oh, yes, you have. The man detached one hand from his stomach and began to move it slowly up his body. So much effort, it was unbearable to watch. The priest said, lie still, it's not there. He could see the holster empty under the armpit. Bastards, the man said, and his hand lay wearily where it got to, over his heart. Listen, Father, the priest sat hopelessly at the man's side. Nothing would shift that violent brain toward peace. Once hours ago, perhaps when he wrote the message. But that chance had come and gone. He was whispering now something about a knife. You believed once. Try and understand. This is your chance. At the last moment, like the thief, you have murdered men, children perhaps. But that need not be so important. It only belongs to this life for a few years. A few years, it's over already. You could drop it all here in this hut and go on forever. He felt sadness and longing at the vaguest idea of a life he couldn't lead himself. Words like peace, glory, love. Father, the voice said urgently, you let me be. You look after yourself. You take my knife. The hand began its weary march again, this time toward the hip. The knees crooked up in an attempt to roll over, and then the whole body gave up the effort, the ghost, everything. The priest hurriedly whispered the words of conditional absolution. In case, for 1 second before it crossed the border, the spirit had repented. But it was more likely that it had gone over still seeking its knife, bent on vicarious violence. He prayed, O merciful God, after all he was thinking of me. It was for my sake. But he prayed without conviction. At the best, it was only one criminal trying to aid the escape of another. Whichever way you looked, there wasn't much merit in either one of them. A voice said, Well, have you finished now? The priest got up and made a small, scared gesture of assent. He recognized the police officer who had given him money at the prison. A smart, dark figure in the doorway with a stormlight glinting on his leggings. He had one hand on his revolver and he frowned sourly at the dead gunman. You didn't expect to see me, he said. Oh, but I did, the priest said. I must thank you. Thank me? What for? For letting me stay alone with him. I am not a barbarian, the officer said. Will you come out now, please? It's no use at all. You're trying to escape. You can see that. He added as the priest emerged and looked round at the dozen armed men surrounding the hut. I have had enough of escaping, he said. The half-caste was no longer in sight. He sighed and giggled nervously. What a lot of trouble I had getting across these mountains, and now here I am. I never believed you would return. Janet, you know how it is. Even a coward has a sense of duty. He said, Are you going to shoot me now? The lieutenant said again, I'm not a barbarian. You will be tried properly. What for?
For treason. I have to go all the way back there.
Yes. Yes, unless you try to escape. He kept his hand on his gun, as if he didn't trust the priest a yard. He said, I could swear that somewhere. Oh, yes, the priest said. You've seen me twice. When you took a hostage from my village, you asked my child, Who is she? She said, My father, and you let me go. It was as if somebody had dashed a handful of water into their faces. Quick, the lieutenant said, into that hut. He called out to one of the men. Bring us some boxes so that we can sit. A candle, the lieutenant said. He sat down on one of the cases and took out his revolver. Sit down there away from the door where I can see you. They looked two of a kind, dirty and unshaved. The lieutenant seemed to belong to a different class altogether. He said, So you have a child? Yes, the priest said. You a priest? You mustn't think they're all like me. He watched the candlelight blink on the bright buttons. There are good priests and bad priests. It's just that I'm a bad priest. Then perhaps we'll be doing your church a servant. Yes. The lieutenant looked up sharply, as if he thought he was being mocked. Now something in his tone infuriated the lieutenant. He said, "You're a danger. That's why we kill you. I have nothing against you. You understand, as a man." "Of course not. It's God you're against." "No, I don't fight against a fiction." "It's your ideas," the lieutenant sweated a little in the hot, steamy air. "You're so cunning, you people, but tell me this. What have you ever done in Mexico for us? Have you ever told a landlord he shouldn't beat his peon?" "Oh, yes, I know. In the confessional, perhaps. And it's your duty, isn't it, to forget it at once? You come out and have dinner with him, and it's your duty not to know that he's murdered a peasant." "We have ideas, too," the lieutenant was saying. "No more money for saying prayers. No more money for building places to say prayers in. We'll give people food instead. Teach them to read. Give them books. We'll see they don't suffer." "But if they want to suffer?" "A man may want to rape a woman. Are we to allow it because he wants to? Suffering is wrong." "And you suffer all the time," the priest commented. "It sounds fine, doesn't it? Does the jefe feel like that, too?" "Oh, we have our bad men. And what happens afterwards? I mean, after everyone has enough to eat and can read the right books. The books you let them read."
"Nothing. That's a fact. We don't try to alter facts."
"We agree about a lot of things," the priest said. "We have facts, too. We don't try to alter. That the world's unhappy whether you're rich or poor. Unless you're a saint, and there aren't many of those. It's not worth bothering too much about a little pain here. There's one belief we both of us have. That we'll all be dead in 100 years. "All the same, you're worried now about a little pain," the lieutenant said maliciously. "But I'm not a saint," the priest said. "I'm not even a brave man."
"Well, you're going to be a martyr. You've got that satisfaction."
"Oh, no. Martyrs are not like me," the lieutenant said to a man in the entrance.
"Well, what is it?" "The storm's over, lieutenant. We wondered when we were to start."
"We start immediately." Outside, the ground was steaming after the rain. The priest mounted, but before they had time to move, a voice made the priest turn. The same sullen whine he had heard so often. "Father," it was the half-caste.
"Well, well," the priest said, "you again."
"Oh, I know what you're thinking," the half-caste said. "There's not much charity in you, father. You thought all along I was going to betray you."
"You're a good man, father."
"But you think the worst of people. I just want your blessing, that's all. I didn't want you to go off thinking ill things."
"You're so superstitious," the priest said. "You think my blessing will be like a blinker over God's eyes? I can't stop him knowing all about it. Much better to go home and pray. Then if he gives you grace to feel sorry, then give away the money." "What, Bonnie? There you go again." The priest sighed. He felt empty with the ordeal. "I'll pray for you." And he beat his horse into the position beside the lieutenant's.